Tim Burkhead of Sheffield, England, at the University of Sheffield out there, has got a book out called Bird Sense. He's known, of course, as the Birdman of South Yorkshire. This is what it's like to be a bird. Okay, you want to do something else, then? We can do something else. I thought it was interesting. This man knows everything there is to know about birds. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. He's written, among other things, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Ornithology. So, I rest my case. And he's with us from Sheffield. Tim, why are they applauding? Take that button away from me. Hi, Tim. How are you this morning?
I'm fine.
Nice to be with you. You were a bird watcher even as a lad, weren't you?
Yeah, I was indeed.
Yes. Was that your father's thing?
Absolutely. Yeah, yes. My dad encouraged me to be interested in birds.
Yeah. And where was this?
Well, it was near Leeds in Yorkshire. So I'm a Yorkshireman through and through.
You're Yorkshire through and through. What sort of species do we have in that part of Yorkshire?
Well, about 30 common species and about 200 species in total.
Yeah.
Red grouse on the moors, very popular with those people that shoot birds.
Red grouse, of course. Yeah. And you're not a hunter, though. You never shot
one. No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Did you ever throw yourself over a grouse that was about to be shot? No, I guess that's a no. Are there any, endangered species in Yorkshire?
Lots of endangered species. Farming's had a devastating effect on birds in the UK, so almost all small birds are in some kind of decline.
Yeah. What's in the biggest decline? It's rare that you see a what in Yorkshire?
Cuckoo.
The cuckoo. Oh, of course, the cuckoo. How terrible.
A very iconic species, but increasingly rare.
That's terrible. What the poets of old would have nothing to write about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. People don't keep birds anymore like they used to in England, though, right? That was a big thing. Actually,
they do in Yorkshire.
They do.
So ex-miners and steelworkers, they're still very keen on keeping their canaries and British birds, yep.
Yeah. Well, that's just for safety purposes, though, isn't it, if you're a miner?
Well, it was, but it kind of modified itself to become a kind of important hobby for them.
Oh. Did the canaries...
It's a way of competing.
The canaries followed them out of the mine? Is that what you said? Interesting. Not in this book, but in a lecture I saw you doing, you're talking about the birds that were kept of old in England. And what was the one that could sing a song?
My favorite of all is the bullfinch. It doesn't occur in North America, but it just has the most amazing ability to mimic a human whistle. And a really good bird could whistle two or three complete tunes. And in the 1800s, they would be worth £1,000 or more.
Yeah. If they could do three tunes, they were $5,000, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I was just read this article, and I thought about you, about the different songs according to locality that birds sing.
Yeah.
Are you aware of this, or do you find this to be true? Like for example, a nightingale in Yorkshire could not really talk to a nightingale from outside of London.
Well, in principle, that's true, if only there were nightingales in Yorkshire, but there are very few nightingales in Yorkshire. Yeah. But definitely, birds, like people, have regional accents. And I don't know whether they wouldn't respond. They might be quite intrigued by the novelty of it.
Oh, okay. But they wouldn't know what they were saying.
I'm not sure whether the birds really know what each other are saying anyway.
All right. Okay, that brings us to the book then, because this is how to think like a bird.
Yeah.
And part of that is, of course, how to hear like a bird and what you're hearing and the calls and so forth. What do we know about that in terms of what birds are actually doing with all those songs?
Well, birds sing for two main reasons. First of all, to kind of announce that they own a particular territory. Mm-hmm. But secondly, to announce their availability to females.
Ah.
So that's the main message that they're giving out.
Yeah. And now when you say availability to females, in what sense?
Okay, so imagine you're a nightingale, a male nightingale. You've just blown back from Africa. You've set yourself up in a territory. You're looking for a partner. You're singing and saying, I own this patch of land, but you also say, I am unpaired, because once you're paired up and your female's on some eggs, you'll stop singing.
Now, the female nightingale, which... Sorry, I didn't mean to step on that. The female nightingale, is she more likely to be attracted by my plumage or by my voice?
She will ignore your plumage completely. she's only interested in your voice.
Okay, and there's nothing that they do like the penguins piling pebbles up at her feet or something like that?
Not in this case. No, no. It's, I mean, for a nightingale, you know, as you know, the world's best singer, song is absolutely everything.
Now, having said that, though, what about promiscuity among the yellow-billed magpies?
Okay, so I studied yellow-billed magpies in California.
Yes.
And although they are what we would call socially monogamous, we'd say the same thing about humans, yeah. Occasionally they're sexually promiscuous. So they form a long-term pair bond, yeah. Male and female, but if the partner's away, they're not averse to having, in Britain we say, a little bit on the side.
Okay. Is this the closest birds come to human behavior?
there are plenty of birds that do that. And, in fact, finding a bird that is strictly monogamous is actually quite a rarity, yeah. But there are some that are spectacularly promiscuous as well. So it's a puzzle why they bother pairing up. So in Australia, there's a little bird called the superb blue wren, and something like 70 or 80% of the offspring are fathered by the chap, by males, other than the one that helps to rear them.
Oh. Well, I can explain that, though.
The average value for humans would be about 10% of us are fathered by the chap next door or whoever, but in birds it can be much greater than that.
Okay, interesting. Or by the chap's bird next door, possibly.
Unlikely.
Now, but what about the European quail as far as the male there? There's, is he promiscuous or is he just good at it?
he's pretty promiscuous, and he will mate with a whole succession of females.
Yeah.
And to allow him to do this, he has enormous testicles because he has to produce copious amounts of sperm.
Understandable.
Yep.
And you have that spermatozoa biannual meeting, don't you?
Yep.
You're still doing that?
Yeah.
Is it this year or was it last year?
It was last year, but it'll be next year.
Yeah. Do you need to have those every 2 years? Could you space them out a little? Do the levels change that much in 2 years?
No, it's a very fast-moving field. There's lots and lots of research in this kind of area. So but 2 years is just right.
It comes in spurts, though. Anyway. Then the female canaries. Now that's an interesting case, don't you think? In terms of all this, they tested her and they gave her testosterone.
Yeah.
And what was the upshot of that?
Okay, so obviously only male canaries sing, and if you're a canary dealer, females are useless because you can't sell them because people only want birds that sing. And then in about the 1930s and 40s, when synthetic testosterone was made for the first time, unscrupulous canary breeders realized that if they gave these females a shot of testosterone, they would sing. And they sang for about 2 weeks, which was just long enough to sell them. So at one level, you know, this is kind of trivial, and of course the owners were very disappointed after a couple of weeks when the birds stopped singing. But from a biological point of view, this actually precipitated a major breakthrough in the way we think about how the brain works. So in Britain at the moment, the government's not very keen on funding what it considers to be trivial research, but I think you can never predict what's going to be monumentally important. So when later somebody investigated what actually happened in the female canary's brain after it had had a shot of testosterone, they discovered something that they thought was impossible. Mm. It was assumed that the neurons in your brain were the ones that you were born with, would be the ones you would die with. But when you give female canaries a shot of testosterone, they grow new neurons. So that means that, if we can figure out what the mechanism of that is, it might be possible to help people who've been in road traffic accidents, might be possible to help people who've got Alzheimer's. So fundamentally important research.
So if you fed people canaries, they could possibly rewire their brains?
Impossible. Possibly.
Yes. The long-tailed sylph. Have you studied this at length? Or?
No, I haven't studied it, but I've observed it.
Yes. And what do you observe when you observe it? What do you note on your observation?
Okay, it's a hummingbird. Mm-hmm. It lives in South America, and it's just the most beautiful little hummingbird you can ever imagine. It's absolutely tiny, just over an inch long, but with a 2 or 3 inch long tail, and it just glitters like polished metal. Fabulous little bird.
Oh, is that your favorite? I know people must ask you all the time if you have a favorite bird. It'd be hard to say. They're all interesting in their own way, but that's probably one of your favorites.
In terms of sheer beauty, the long-tailed sylph beats everything, yeah.
Yeah. But you got to admit, the bar-tailed godwits are really something.
Yeah, well, people have always been fascinated by migration and how birds find their way.
That's amazing.
And In the last few years, there's been an absolute revolution in migration studies. Prior to that, we used to have to just put rings on birds and then hopefully get a recovery. But in the last few years, rather sophisticated tracking devices have been put on birds. And it turns out that Bartel godwits are able to fly from Alaska to their wintering grounds in New Zealand in one continuous flight that takes about 7 days.
Yeah.
And in terms of feats of endurance and navigation, that is just absolutely mind-boggling.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Non-stop.
Non-stop.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
The Lindbergh of birds.
Absolutely, yeah.
Unbelievable. This is it called the Guillemot?
Yeah.
Yes, the Guillemot. Is that a bird that you studied quite a bit, or it seems to come up quite a bit?
I spent most of my life studying that. I've just come back from doing fieldwork on Skomer Island, which is where I did my PhD in the 1970s, and I've been back every year since. So this is my 40th field season studying guillemots.
Yeah, is that off of Canada or is that near you?
I have studied them in Canada. I've studied them in Newfoundland and Labrador, but this is off the coast of Wales.
Yeah. Explain your fascination with the guillemot.
Okay, scientists aren't supposed to be anthropomorphic, but sometimes you can't help it. And guillemots are basically like people. You know, they live at very high densities. They have long-term pair bonds like people. They're pretty promiscuous like people. They form friendships. They fall out with each other. They have fights. And, they're just fantastic. They might live 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. So do you go back, do you see guillemots that you've known from before?
So we've got a lot of birds that are wearing a colored ring or a numbered ring.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as I say, some of our birds are 20 or 30 years old, so it's like going back and seeing old friends. And they always nest in exactly the same spot year after year, a tiny little territory, just a few square inches in size. And so you kind of always know when they're there, you can go back and look at exactly where they're breeding and tick them off to see whether they're still alive.
Yeah. Are these the ones that you were hooking with a fishing pole?
Absolutely, yep.
Just to band them, then you release them again.
So we band them, but we also put these little tracking devices on them, geolocators and GPS trackers, so that we can see where they go in the winter, and we can also see where they go to feed their chicks.
Yeah. Don't they catch on pretty quick, though, that this guy's got a fishing pole up here? And
Yeah. Catching them the first time is a piece of cake. Catching them the second time is a pain in the bum.
Cooperative breeders.
Yep.
Is that right? That's interesting. Is that unusual in the bird world? Or?
Sure. A very small proportion of birds are said to be cooperative. The guillemots are kind of a bit of a funny case in terms of cooperative, but they will look after each other's young if a parent has to go off and do something. Normally, one bird stays at the colony, at the breeding site, the whole time. But there are some other birds which are obligatorily cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And birds, in those species, they never breed as pairs. They always have to have these extra birds, which are called helpers.
Ah.
And so these helpers literally do what the name suggests. They help with the incubation. They help with feeding the chicks. And those kind of birds often exist in environments where it's hard to collect enough food for feeding the chicks. So a pair wouldn't be able to manage on its own. But by having these helpers, they're able to find enough food and produce a family.
Right. And this in the chapter on emotion of birds, this is where you get into the difficulties of describing what their behavior actually means. I mean, is it altruism? Probably not.
Well, in terms of emotions, this is the $64,000 question, but there are some things that you see that strongly suggest that there must be something going on in the bird's brain. A lot of people suggest that birds are just like automata, but I would argue that they're definitely not. So there's one little example that I talk about in the book where a pair of gannets are rearing their egg. The egg hatches, and just as the chick hatches, the female disappears. And she disappears for 5 weeks. And against all the odds, the male manages to rear this tiny chick all on his own without his female. And my colleague saw the female on the day she came back. And so she'd been away for 5 weeks, which is unprecedented. Normally they'd be away, you know, for 12 hours or 24 hours at an absolute maximum. So she's away for 5 weeks. My colleague sees this bird come back, and instead of going through a greeting ceremony, you know, hugging and kissing in human terms for 5 minutes, they do this for 20 minutes. And, you know, that's unprecedented. And that tells you that there's something very special going on in the bird's brain in terms of an emotional response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And the guillemot, they're very social and cooperative, except under stress, as you mentioned in the book. There's something horrible. If the stress is hard enough or big enough, it changes entirely.
Yep. So there was so guillemot populations around the coast of Britain. Some are going having a good time. So on Skomer things are fine, but further north in Scotland, possibly as a result of overfishing or climate change, food, the fish that they feed their chicks on, is incredibly scarce. And a few years ago, food was almost non-existent. So the birds laid their eggs, everything was fine, they incubated the eggs, the chicks hatched, and then when the adults came to search for food for the chicks, they couldn't find enough. So both parents would often leave their chick unattended, which is unprecedented, and in other conditions when that happens, as I've just said, sometimes another adult will look after a chick, but in this case where the food was short, the birds were so stressed, they were literally throwing each other's chicks off the cliff ledges, you know, really awful behavior. And if the chick wasn't thrown off the ledge, most of them starved to death anyway. So the birds, the adult birds, went from being incredibly social and altruistic to being kind of mean and selfish. And, you know, as I say in the book, that there's very strong human parallels there. People in prison don't always behave in the nicest possible way, you know, because they're under stress.
Yeah. Now the herring gulls. You know, the chick, when they peck at that red spot on their parent's beak?
Sure.
What's that all about?
Well, that little red spot on the parent's beak is called a releaser. And so the chick is programmed to peck at that spot, and then in response to that, the adult herring gull regurgitates food and the chick gets fed.
Yeah. Have we learned a great deal, or a little bit, or an immense amount since Darwin made some of his early conclusions about these behaviors?
That's a great question. We've learned a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a book on the history of 20th century ornithology at the moment, and we calculated how many scientific papers on birds have been published since Darwin's day, and it's about 500,000. So that's pretty phenomenal. So the knowledge base has just increased exponentially.
Yeah. How were his instincts?
He was spot on.
He was.
We're still using Darwin's questions as our basis for understanding ornithology and indeed every other aspect of biology.
Yeah. But birds were not as... Didn't he start with snails or something like that, or mollusks?
Yeah. Well, barnacles were...
Barnacles.
He spent 8 years dissecting barnacles, but he was very broad. He wouldn't have defined himself as a barnacle expert or a bird expert. He was a biologist. But he did have a lot of interest in birds. He kept pigeons and watched their behavior very closely. So he was just a very perceptive guy.
Yeah. Are we due for breakthroughs, further breakthroughs in bird understanding, behavior?
Almost certainly.
Yes. And what form do you think they will take?
Okay, well, the molecular revolution that's happened over the last 20, 30 years has had a huge impact on our understanding. Technology like these tracking devices is causing an absolute revolution in the way we understand migration, the way the birds perceive the Earth's magnetic field. That's on the brink of major discoveries. For me, what the $64,000 question is concerned with promiscuity. We know why males are promiscuous, because by being promiscuous, they produce more offspring. The real question is, why are females promiscuous? We don't yet have a good answer for that, because if a female's promiscuous, she doesn't produce any more offspring. And the evidence seems to suggest that she's not actually producing any better quality offspring. So I think we probably need a whole change of outlook in terms of trying to answer that particular question.
Yeah. And on this side of it, too.
Yep.
I think. Well, Tim Burkett, I want to thank you so much. The book is called Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Fascinating stuff. I appreciate it. Tim Burkett, University of Sheffield in England, the Birdman of Yorkshire.